Good afternoon, I'm Don Burgess, and with me today is the OBA's Leah Scott. Her portfolios include tourism, transport, and economic development. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Don. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You have said things have to change in Bermuda. I want to be an agent for change. Why is that important for you?
Well, I think that change doesn't happen just by saying it. I think that it's important for all of us who live in Bermuda to do things to make Bermuda a better place. And I'm not the type of person that will sit back and just complain and say, I want something to happen. I'm a person who's willing to get out there and do things to help things happen. So I am not actually a born Bermudian. I was born in the States, came to Bermuda as a child, acquired Bermuda status in 2007. Actually relocated to Bermuda in 1984, and since coming back to Bermuda, I've always been involved in community service, served on various boards. When my son got involved in sports, I was a member of various organizations that he participated in. So I think it's important to always be a part of your community. Change doesn't happen by just sitting back and wishing that it happens.
Now, just to broaden on that, your dad worked at the
My dad was a pilot in the Air Force. Yep.
So how does the other cultural aspects of you be living in another country for a while help you as a politician today bringing those things into Bermuda?
I actually have been in Bermuda more than I lived in the States. I lived here from 59 to 66, and then my father was transferred to Andrews Air Force Base, and I went to school, middle school, high school there, university, and came back to Bermuda in 1984. So I lived in the States from 66 to 84, and then I've been in Bermuda since 1984, so I've spent more time in Bermuda than I have in the States. So I actually think that I'm a Bermudian. People would argue and say, oh, I'm just a paper Bermudian, but my heart is here. This is my community. This is where my family is.
One of the things that you're very concerned about are social issues. From being out with the people, what do you see as some of the major issues that are affecting Bermudians today?
Well, the major issue affecting most Bermudians is that people don't have jobs. And I'm sure you're aware that we had the living wage debate in the House, I guess it's 2 weeks ago now, and people that are working are not making enough to sustain their lives or their families, and the people that aren't working are either relying on financial assistance, and if they can't get financial assistance, then they're relying on family members. But we've got to create jobs for people. The government, the premier in his report on the last day of sitting of the House said that they had created 322 jobs, which is a good step in the right direction. Part of the challenge I see is that it's not so much that we don't have jobs in Bermuda, but we don't have people who have the skills to match the jobs that are available. So there's a whole process that needs to happen in terms of retooling people, retraining them. There are things, education costs money, and so people may not have the money to be retooled and reskilled. And so one of the things that we should be looking at, or the government should be looking at, is how we can equip people to meet the job market and the requirements that are there. Workforce development has a very important role in terms of assessing the skill set that people have and getting them the necessary training that they need to be prepared for the jobs that are coming available. You know, the government has introduced FinTech and all the jobs and the training that are supposed to evolve out of that. And my understanding is that the money that will come from those companies that are investing in Bermuda will be in the compliance area, but there's only so many compliance jobs that you can fill. So what are going to be the ancillary jobs that come out as a result of FinTech? The lawyers and the accountants are going to have jobs, because you're going to have somebody to incorporate the companies and somebody to manage the accounts and that kind of thing. But what are the mid to lower level jobs that are going to evolve out of FinTech?
You mentioned the top end of the scale where Bermudians don't have the skill sets because they're accountants, lawyers, or reinsurance industry or whatever. But at the lower end, there's simply, at least according to my research, there's jobs that just don't pay enough. You know, Bermudians aren't going to want to work for $6 an hour or $8 an hour because it's $15,000 for the year. That's not enough money to. So how do we help that with the living wage? Is the living wage going to be able to help that? Are you on the committee. Joint Select Committee. So
yes, I think that the living wage is a step, but the truth of the matter is that in conjunction with a living wage, there's got to be a corresponding uplift in the skills of workers, because employers are not going to want to pay them a living living wage without them being able to, they want $20 out of their employee. If they're going to pay them $20, they want $20 worth of work out of them. But in addition to that, there also has to be an assessment of the cost of living in Bermuda. Bermuda is one, if not the most expensive, one of the most expensive places on earth to live. And so, you know, you look at the cost of groceries. I went to the grocery store the other day, bread, chicken, milk. You're spending $30, $40 for simple things. And that's just me as a single person. So what do if you have a family of four and you have to have breakfast for your children in the morning and lunches and dinner and, you know, those kind of things. The cost of electricity, you know, solar panels reduce electricity. Maybe there could be some sort of government subsidy or some sort of partnership between government and Belco where solar panels can be put on people's houses to assist them to bring down the cost of electricity. Healthcare is another one that's very expensive. I was speaking to somebody the other day who said that a woman hadn't worked, who had an abscess, and couldn't go to the dentist because she didn't have insurance and didn't have the money to pay for treatment. People shouldn't have to live like that in this country. So in addition to having an increase in the wages that people earn, there has to be a reduction in the cost of things in Bermuda.
It's easier said than done.
It's very easy to say, but you know, how do we do it? We don't make anything, we don't export anything, but it's the purchasing power that people don't have, and that's what people need.
I think it was in California that passed legislation now where any time a new house is built, it has to have solar panels on it.
Okay.
It's kind of, you know, obviously the housing industry and the banks were against it because it raises the cost of the house, but at the same time they're trying to cut
makes it affordable
in the long run. What do you think of I'm just bringing this on you, so what do you think about something like that?
I think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there are other options too outside of a living wage. I mean, there's the what do you call it? Where the government is going to invest in the people.
Some sort of education
system? No, it's, I can't remember the name of it. Where the government gives a subsidy to people.
Oh, basic minimum? Universal basic income.
Yes, universal basic income, yeah. Because I know that, and then there's the UBI, and then there's a guaranteed minimum income. Yeah. And I know that, I think it's Stockton, California, where the mayor there has actually instituted that they've given a select, they've kind of got a pilot program going, and they've given a select group of people $500 a month. They're not telling them how to spend it, what to do with it, but they're doing this to see whether or not this assists them in their day-to-day living and whether people are going to make the right choices if they are given that subsidy. You know, are they going to spend it on their bills? Are they going to be able to manage their money? And that's the other thing is that, you know, not only do we want to increase the wages of people, but we also have to learn how to manage money. You know, it's all right if I give somebody more money in their pay packet, but if they're managing it in a way that doesn't assist them, they're still back to square one. They're still not being able to make ends meet because they're not managing the money the way, and it's not a criticism of how people live. I'm just saying that there's a whole myriad of things that have to come together in addition to the living wage.
Right. Well, I know, I used to be a deacon at a church, and I went to, this lady asked for some Belco assistance, and went and investigated her house, and she had the full cable package with all the movie channels, and she had full program for her cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, here's part of your problem. You're spending your money on these
right.
rather than
focusing on what the what's important, really important things are, like food and transportation and groceries and things like that. But, you know, people want the luxuries, and people should be able to live in their own country with dignity, and that's the bottom line. You know, and so how do we get there? I don't know, but we've got to get there. We can't have people living without dignity.
From your time on the Living Wage Committee, what were some of the most shocking things that you saw in the reports?
I think the most shocking thing to me is the school children, children that go to school and they don't get breakfast, and the number of children that are supported by schools that actually provide breakfast programs. And it's hard to live in a country that has a great deal of wealth and see people that are suffering and know people that are suffering and not be able to do something about it. And as I said, you know, the government is trying to put things in place, but the fact of the matter is that there has to be a whole bunch of things that have to happen. It's not just one thing.
As far as the living wage goes, at what point, what wage do you think that Bermudians will start considering some of maybe these lower skilled jobs, like at clerks and things? You know, is it $10 an hour, $15 an hour? Where does it become think, well, I don't want to be on financial assistance, I can go earn this money for myself, and this is a decent enough wage for me to earn?
I can't say. All things are relative. People have different needs, people have different priorities, and the reality is that we can't impose a living wage on anybody until there's consultation with industry and the unions. You know, it's all right to say to an employer that we want you to pay somebody $18 an hour. $18 an hour is the minimum net pay to the employee, but the loaded pay to the loaded cost to the employer is what, $26, $27. You've got insurance, you've got payroll tax, social insurance, all those kind of things. So, you know, I think that you've got to, and the reality is that I think that a lot of employers in Bermuda are paying between $12 and $15 an hour. So who we need to catch are the employers that are exploiting people and paying them $6 an hour and $8 an hour, or not paying them overtime on public holidays or time and a half. That's who we need to catch, and that's who needs to start, you know, stepping up their game and paying people what they're worth.
It's tough because some people say, well, that business might not be able to function by paying more.
But, you know, I think that there are instances where, you know, businesses can fall, and it's true. You know, you look in the U.S. where they've imposed a living wage, and places like McDonald's and Wendy's have installed kiosks. So you just go in and you push a button, and then the cashier hands you your food. You know, so that's taking away jobs from people. There's always going to be a downside, but we have to do whatever we can, as I said, to restore dignity to people and allow them to be. There's something wrong when you can't survive in your own country. When people have to move to England and other places in order to survive, when they'd rather be here in the country of their birth. That's not fair. And it's also not fair that, you know, other people get the benefit of the country that may not be Bermudian. And I'm not saying that I'm not for anybody that isn't Bermudian, but Bermudians should be able to live in their country and to be able to more than just live. They should be able to survive and live comfortably.
You mentioned the computer revolution, AI taking jobs away. I know, like when I was with my mom over Christmas, I went into Walmart and they had 20 self-check machines and only two cashiers.
Right.
I went into Home Depot, they had one cashier and eight self-check, but there were lots of businesses moving away from actually
having humans
do the checkout process. But they will all say that removing these people to other positions within the company allows them to do something else.
Right. Well, where are they? You know what I mean? And, you know, that's a justification for them not wanting to pay people. And it's unfortunate, you know. I look at, I think education is key. Mm-hmm. And education is key in people getting. See, I think that people shouldn't work for the least amount of money that somebody has to pay them. And part of that problem is because the skills aren't to the level that they could get a higher salary. But, you know, in addition to paying them a living wage or getting them up to where they need to be, we've got to increase people's skills so that they're not just reliant on a living wage for the next 10 years. You enhance their skills and they get better jobs, and as they get better jobs and they progress, then their income progresses with their skills. So we can't have people dissatisfied with just getting a living wage. You know, we want people to progress and to progress solidly, and again, to be able to live in their country and afford to live in their own country. Mm. So education is really, really important. And I was saying all that to say that there is, in New Jersey, they have a program called 65-25. And by 2025, they want to have 65% or more of their population either having some sort of certification or some sort of college degree or some sort of piece of paper that allows them to get a job beyond minimum wage. There is also the school that LeBron James has just founded, and I think it's, I call it the Promise School in Akron, Ohio. But in addition to the kids getting an education, they have a program where parents who don't have a GED can get a GED. They also have a program where parents don't have jobs, they have a job placement program. So they've created this whole holistic kind of environment. So it's not just addressing the needs of the children, but it's also addressing the needs of the parents, and it's also getting the parents involved in the children's education. Why couldn't we do something like that here in Bermuda?
Well, they are looking to change and move, get rid of the middle schools and go to the just a secondary school situation. Do you feel like that's going to help? And they have those, I want to call them magnet schools, but they're not magnet schools, but special schools for to convert some of the, what were middle schools, I guess, into specially to help the kids.
Yeah, education is a key component for any society, and it's a very difficult one to get right. But if you look at places like Finland, who has a very good education system, I think Iceland has a very good education system. Part of the challenge, I believe, is, I don't know if teachers were like very important when you were growing up, but when I was growing up, teachers were the mainstay of my education. And I don't think the teachers are valued anymore. I think it's Iceland. You have to have a master's degree or a doctorate before you can be a teacher. And it makes sense because when you look at it, your child spends 8 to 10 hours at school with somebody. And don't you want the person that's depositing into your child to be of a level that you know is going to be a good deposit? And I'm not saying that we don't have teachers. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that teachers are not valued. And I think that early childhood education is very important. I think that a lot of times parents think that teachers are supposed to do all the work, and there's not enough work being done at home with children before they start school. And so, and then that comes all around back to the living wage, because people can't be home with their children because they've got to be out working 2 and 3 jobs. And so it's just a vicious cycle.
One of the things that you're very big on is work-life balance. And how do you think people pursuing that dollar, maybe sometimes because they have to, sometimes, you know, people do it just because they want to keep up with the Joneses or the
right.
Smiths or the Ferberts or
right.
whoever they are, whoever else it may be. But why do you think work-life balance is important?
Because I think family is important. And I think that there shouldn't be any job that you have that supersedes your relationship with your family. And I think that, you know, in my generation coming up, we thought that we had to give our children a better life. And as I reflect on it, I had a good life. You know, I played outside. I wasn't stuck in front of a computer or an iPad or a phone or any other piece of technology. We had good relationships with kids. We had good relationships with kids. There was more interaction. And so I think that it's important that if you're working, you know, my job isn't 9 to 5. It will never be 9 to 5. But I enjoy it, and that's my choice. But, you know, generally, if you give your employer a good 8 hours or 9 hours a day, there's a cutoff time when you should be able to also be able to enjoy your family. And your family deserves that. One of the things that my son always complained about to me was, "Mama, you're always working, you're always working." And my reply was, "I'm working so that you can have a better life."
Do you feel like women get more caught up into this than men, or what are some extra struggles that women face than men in this situation?
I think women are always thought of as being the weaker sex. I think that women are devalued. I can tell you that in my role as legal counsel, I'm legal counsel for the Harbor Group of companies, and it is a group of companies that provide various services, trust administration, corporate services, fund administration. And most of the time, I'm the only one woman in the boardroom. And not only the only woman, but the only black woman. However, my employer, I have a lot of respect for. And I don't feel isolated in any way. I am included in all management decisions. I am included in all aspects of the business. But I know that not all women have that opportunity. And so I'm grateful for the job that I have. I've been there, I think, 7 years in November. And for the employer and for the opportunities that he has given me. But a lot of women don't get that chance. A lot of women don't get to move up. A lot of women don't get opportunity just because they're women. And the reality is that the world consists of predominantly white men working, making all the money.
So how do women, is there then an impetus for women to, or not women in general, but black women to help extend a hand out and help lift somebody else up so that there's more women involved?
We should do that, but that's a whole another show, but at the end of the day, women aren't always willing to support each other. Women are not always willing to help each other get ahead. And I'm thankful that I have had a really good support group, and I have mentored young women as well, but not everybody has that opportunity. But it is important for us to stick together as women, whether we're black, whether we're white, whether we're Asian, whether we're Portuguese, we're women. It doesn't matter what our color is, we're women. And so we should be sticking together to make sure that we are treated fairly, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's socially, in all respects. And, you know, it's kind of disconcerting, all of the kind of sexual harassment things that are going on, you know, the whole Me Too movement, and where women feel that they have to sleep with somebody in order to get ahead, or they've got to sacrifice their dignity in order to get ahead. You should be able to get ahead because you have the requisite skill sets. A man doesn't have to sleep with anybody to get ahead. He gets ahead because he's a man.
Right. Part of your switching gears here. So part of your portfolio is transport.
Yes.
So you relayed an incident from this weekend where you had some people have problems with taxis.
Right, coming into the airport, there were not enough, and it's not the first time that it's happened. There were not enough taxis at the airport. And so I think in one instance, maybe the BTA has done too good of a job, and I say that tongue in cheek, because we've got great visitor arrivals. I mean, visitor arrivals have consistently gone up since 2015. So to their credit, the BTA has been fantastic in marketing Bermuda and getting people here and making us a destination where people want to be. But we also have to have the resources available for when people come here. I don't know why there are not enough taxis at the airport. I know that Dockyard has been extremely busy. Do we not have enough people on the road? I don't know the answer. Do we need to have minibuses down at the airport as well as being at Dockyard? But, you know, we want to have a first-class tourism product all around. And so I think it's important that we get a handle on that.
Also, I guess today it was announced two of the buses had to get sent back because they had rust on them to the manufacturer. You know, and I'm not blaming the PLP on this because these bus troubles
have been long-standing. Yep.
Why haven't we been able to find a solution for this?
I think part of the problem is that there is, and I think this has been an ongoing problem, is that the bus schedule needs to go to arbitration. Mm-hmm. And until that happens, I think that we will continue to have these challenges. And I do believe that the minister has been working on a schedule. So it's unfortunate that the buses had to go back. It's unfortunate because school's getting ready to start. And so how many school children are going to be impacted in terms of being able to get to school? And how many families are going to be impacted in terms of being able to get to work because there are not enough buses on the road, there are not enough bus routes? You know, and I think one of the things that we probably should look at doing is having somebody ride all the bus routes and see how many people actually ride bus routes. And, you know, where you have the ones that are less densely populated and there are not as many riders, then maybe you can cut back on those routes. And the ones that are greater populated and there are more people using those routes, then you have more buses on those routes. It's a challenge, you know, and, you know, there's also the budget issue. Do we have enough money to acquire new buses? So for the buses that have been sent back, what's going to be the turnaround time to get new buses back to Bermuda? Do we have to wait until next year for them to come? Do the buses that we actually bring into Bermuda now, are they the right kind of buses in terms of, could we get something that's smaller? Could we get something that we could, that takes less time to build? Does it have to be specifically built for Bermuda? You know, are we able to kind of go in and pick a bus that kind of has almost all the bells and whistles that we need on it and add things, but still get buses here in a timely fashion?
I had an interview with one of your former colleagues, or still a member of the OBA, Jeff Souza. And Jeff had a proposal to bring in some electric buses as an agent, and you know, Jeff said that he would do it at very minimum profit for himself. What do you think the idea of electric buses and the buses being able to charge themselves as they?
I think it's a good idea, actually. I think mostly everywhere is going green. I'm looking at getting an electric car. I'm not a mechanic, obviously, but I do know that with the electric cars, you have a battery and I guess minimal kind of inner workings. So I would imagine that the maintenance would be less. I guess the biggest challenge would be just keeping a supply of batteries on hand. I don't know what the battery life is of an electric bus. I don't know how long the charge is for an electric bus. But I think that in terms of an option, sure, why not?
Yeah, because he when I was talking with him, he's talking about, you know, in some cities they actually have the reach, you know, the bus can recharge as it's going on the road because they
Oh, right, because they have charge centers.
Yeah, and they have underneath the road, so the bus is constantly getting a charge, or at the bus stations when they sit there, it gets a brief bit of a charge before it goes on, or there's a charge center at the end so that you're not having to worry about the bus. Trying to go,
down.
You know, Birdhouse Hill and sort of thing. What other issues do you see with transportation happening in Berea? I know some people are in favor of maybe expanding Twizzies to as a way to get around. It seems to be very popular with the tourists.
Yeah, it is very popular. And actually, you know, I have some friends that have actually rented Twizzies for a weekend, you know, and just kind of, I've never driven in one. But yeah, sure. Yeah. I think it would be a good tourism product. They're safer than bikes. And I don't know of anybody who's had an accident in a Twizzy. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that they won't, but I think that they've proven that they're safer.
But again, part of that thing is there was a lot of resistance to the
before in the beginning.
Why, because it's a change, and you know, the example I like to put up, it took us Bermudians, you know, more than 50 years to allow automobiles on our roads because we were afraid of what was going to happen to the bicycle dealers and the horse and carriage dealers.
Yeah,
why are we so afraid of change sometimes?
Because change is uncomfortable. It's unknown. You don't know what's going to happen, and we all have a fear of the unknown. And then the biggest example is, remember Y2K? Mm-hmm. And everybody was storing up water and people's computers were gonna blow up and here we are in what, 2018? Mm-hmm. And nothing's happened. It's the fear of what you don't know. And then when it comes, it turns out that it's actually pretty okay. I mean, look at when jet skis first came to Bermuda and, you know, they were gonna mess up the coral reefs and they were gonna do all these things. And now they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Do you think part of not wanting that change had an effect on what happened at Shelley Bay?
I think so. But I think that, you know, it's hard. People don't like change. The BTA was tasked with increasing tourism, expanding the tourism product in Bermuda. Mm-hmm. And the reason the BTA was set up was so that it could be independent and free from political interference. And it has clearly worked thus far. Glenn Jones and Kevin Dallas have done a fantastic job, and I wholeheartedly support them and the minister. I think that Minister Simmons has done a really, really good job in terms of working with the BTA, keeping hands off, allowing them to do what it is that they need to do. I understand that the special interest group that objected to the Shelley Bay Beach product was not happy with containers being utilized, as I guess, for the vendors. And I was at a conference last year, and one of the people at the conference actually presented apartments that were made out of containers, and they were fantastic. You couldn't even tell that they were containers. So I guess that sometimes the inability to visualize how things would look or how it's going to pan out. And you know, I understand that you don't want that, not in my backyard.
Right.
So I understand that. But equally, the government has promised to create entrepreneurial opportunities. And the minister himself has said, you know, that we are going to create opportunities for Bermudians. We are going to create opportunities for entrepreneurs. The minister backed the tourism project. He backed the plan. And, you know, one of the things that he said in an interview was that Bermudians are the island of no. We are the island of no. He said if this was going to happen on the moon, there would still be naysayers. So it's the unknown, but the fact of the matter is that we're going to have to do things that are just not traditional. And not traditional doesn't mean that you step on the toes of your constituents and don't listen to what they say or what they want. Because at the end of the day, we are public servants. We are elected by our constituents, and we have to listen to them and carry out their agenda. But we also have to be realistic. This isn't the Bermuda of, you know, before 2007 and before the recession. So we've got to be creative in doing a lot of things.
You said you wholeheartedly support the BTA. I know you also wholeheartedly support the OBA. But sometimes you can be an outspoken critic of your own party when you don't feel like they're listening to the people.
Yes.
And you don't see that very often, where, especially in Bermuda, where somebody's willing to say, look, I'm backing the party, but I don't necessarily agree with this. Why do you feel comfortable enough to do it? Maybe other people feel that way, but they
the OBA selected me, but the OBA didn't elect me. I'm elected by my constituents, and I will represent my constituents to the best of my ability. And if there's something that they are all gung-ho about, then I will represent them to the best of my ability. However, there will be times where my principles do not line up with that of the OBA or that of the PLP or that of my constituents. And so my principles will always prevail. At the end of the day, right is right and wrong is wrong, and it doesn't matter whether you're PLP or you're OBA. And I think that it's that's what's important.
Do you think it's more important, or do you, well, not more important, but do you think it's important that all politicians find their voice that way?
Yes.
Why so?
Because you can't just be a yes person or a no person. And I understand the party line, and I understand, you know, buying into the general and overall philosophy. But if something is going against your grain personally, then why do you agree with it? Why would you agree with it?
Maybe you're looking for future rewards down the line?
Maybe. Maybe. But for me, it's just, you know, I'm not here for the money. I'm here to try to help people. I'm here to do better for Bermuda. I'm here to do better for my community. I was elected by my constituents. That's who I represent as a member of the OBA. I support the OBA. I support the party. But when I don't think that they're going in the right direction, then I'm going to say.
Because part of the thing, too, is like we've seen over the last 10 years, a lot of people who didn't necessarily agree with the OBA, they just crossed the floor. So you're saying,
this is the team I joined. I'm not crossing the floor. I have no interest in going anywhere else. And I will stay here and do what I have to do from the inside to help make the OBA be the best that it can be.
There you go. You heard it from Leah Scott. She's going to make the OBA the best that it can be, even if she doesn't necessarily agree 100% with everything.
Absolutely.
I'm Don Burgess, and we just want to thank you for joining us on Facebook Live for
Bernie's.
Thank you, Leah. Hope you all have a beautiful afternoon.